Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Buffy St. Marie was born to Cree parents on a reserve in the Qu'Appelle Valley in Saskatchewan, but was adopted and raised by a Mi'kmaq family in Massachusetts. She grew up musically inclined and sang folk songs in Yorkville and Greenwich Village coffee houses. Her dynamic guitar style and distinctive vibrato set her apart. The songs she wrote and performed climbed the charts and were covered by hundreds of other musicians, from Elvis to Donovan, Joni Mitchell to Barbara Streisand. Her song Universal Soldier became an anthem of the anti-war movement, while Now That the Buffalo's Gone did the same for the American Indian movement. She starred in movies on TV, became a regular on Sesame Street, won countless awards, and to this day is the only Indigenous person to have won an Oscar. Her story is told in a new documentary by Madison Thomas called Buffy St. Marie, Carry It On, narrated by Taj Mahal, Robbie Robertson, Joni Mitchell, Alanis Obomsawin, and many others, and Buffy St. Marie herself. Of course, it combines period footage and personal photos, dramatizations, and lots of music and concerts, both vintage and new. The film is having its world premiere at TIFF, and I'm very pleased to have here with us on location at TIFF, Buffy St. Marie herself, to tell us more.
Hi, Buffy. Daniel.
Hi, Buffy.
That was nice. Can I make some corrections?
Please.
I used to be the only Indigenous person to win an Academy Award, but a couple years ago, Taika Waititi, who is half Maori.
That's true.
He won, so now
that's
there were
true.
Two of us. And I used to be the only Native American person to win an Academy Award, but they gave Wes Studi an honorary one
last year
for his body of work, which I thought was very appropriate. And I like it that they did. And I'm the only question that I have is, where's Tantu Cardinals? Come on.
That's right.
Because her body of work, too, has been just extraordinary.
Amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were brought up in the eastern United States, not on a reserve, and with no other Indigenous kids around you when you're growing up. And yet, here you are, the most famous Native singer. What point did you rediscover your roots?
Well, it's not exactly like that. The family who adopted and raised me were, my adoptive mom was part Mi'kmaq.
Oh, okay.
We used to say Mi'kmaq in those days. And we were living in Maine and Massachusetts. And the dad was of an Italian background.
Oh, okay.
So my mom was like part Mi'kmaq, and then the rest was, Scotch-Irish.
Right.
But they didn't know anything about Indigenous anything. And my mom was so kind. She, I was told two things when I was growing up. One, that I couldn't be a musician because I couldn't read music. So I was shunned and shamed in music classes and not allowed to. They thought that I couldn't be a musician because I couldn't read European notation. Then I'd go home and play fake Tchaikovsky all over the place on the piano. So I was a natural musician, which many musicians are, who can't read music worth a darn. Wes Montgomery and even Irving Berlin, he couldn't read music.
He did it all by ear, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We all do it by ear. And since there's no money in that for lessons, it's overlooked. It's largely overlooked. So I was told I couldn't be a musician. I was also told that I couldn't be an Indian because there aren't any more. In Maine and Massachusetts, it just wasn't a thing. There was one other Indigenous person in my town, and he was the mailman.
Oh.
And he was a Narragansett Indian.
Okay.
And he used to make beautiful headdresses for the movies.
Oh.
He was a beautiful artist, yeah. And so he was really the only Indigenous person, besides my mom, who didn't know very much, in my childhood. And my mom used to tell me, I'm sorry, I don't know very much, but when you grow up, you can find out. And that was the greatest gift that she could have given me. She made sure that I got to go to college. My dad didn't see any point in a girl going to college, but my mom took a loan and allowed me to go to the University of Massachusetts.
Oh, very good school.
A very good school. And I majored in Oriental philosophy. I have a degree in Oriental philosophy and another in teaching. Wow. So I don't know what I'm doing sitting with you here today at TIFF, Daniel, but somehow between being a teacher and a philosopher, I wound up in show business, and here we are.
So, but there you were, you're famous, you have all these top hits, you're selling the albums, everything like this, and then, and you're also supporting AIM, the American Indian Movement.
Well, that was in the 70s. In the 60s, but right. AIM was in the 70s, yep.
But then suddenly your career tanked. What happened?
Well, my career didn't exactly tank, but in the U.S. I couldn't get airplay anymore.
I was having
a brilliant career in Europe and Asia. I mean, I was hanging out with Bruce Lee in Hong Kong and spending time in the 30 degrees north of the Arctic Circle with Sami indigenous people in Scandinavia.
Wow.
You know, and then going to Australia and doing, you know, fancy concerts in Sydney and Melbourne, etc., and then spending time with Aboriginal people in Australia. So that kind of is what my life was like during the 60s and the 70s.
But I'm interested in why weren't the radio stations playing your songs in the U.S.?
Well, I just figured at the time that singers come and singers go, and, you know, it's somebody else's turn. I didn't think anything of it. And it wasn't until 20 years later when a radio broadcaster told me that he wanted to apologize to me on the air for having gone along. He had a letter on White House stationery commending him for suppressing my music, and he said that the words would deserve to be suppressed. So when I found that out, I the interview went on, and we talked about other stuff, and I left. And a few weeks later, I mentioned it to my lawyer, and he said, you know what, we ought to get your FBI files. And I said, I don't have any FBI files, and I've never broken the law. I didn't smoke pot on the White House lawn. I didn't throw rocks and signs, you know, at people. You know, I've never broken the law. So we did get the FBI files. Now, this is 20 years after my career had been drowned in the U.S., 20 years later. So I had been everywhere except the U.S. And we did get the FBI files, and it showed that I had been under surveillance. But it really is inaccurate to say that it was the U.S. government. I don't have a problem with the U.S. government in that regard, because the way it happens is that we elect somebody for 4 years, and he and a handful of his buddies do what they want to do. But it's not as though they did something legal to me. You know, they didn't pass an act of Congress against my music or John Lennon's music or anybody else. It's all under the table. A couple of guys go in the back room and they make nasty phone calls to the TV and radio networks. And the next time you're invited onto the Tonight Show, you're highly screened. You're told not to talk about any activist stuff and just to sing a love song and stick to celebrity chat, and of course you don't do the show. So no, that's how it happened. So it wasn't the U.S. government,
but the FBI.
No, it wasn't the FBI either. No, they had me under surveillance. I'm telling you, it's a couple of private citizens who are buddies of whoever's trying to sink your boat.
Wow.
No, and people don't really understand that. We all want to blame the institution. Just like in Universal Soldier, it's not just about the army. It's about you and me.
Right.
We're the ones. It's individual people who can make a difference.
Right.
But a lot of us just don't want to.
Another interesting thing in the documentary was you were cast in a role on The Virginian, which is a popular TV Western at the time.
Yes, it was the first ever two-hour movie for television, and it was a series.
So oh, it was and a big deal. James Garner?
It was, oh gosh, John McIntyre.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you said you would do it, but under certain conditions. What were those conditions? Why was it so crucial?
Well, I told them in the first place the part they were offering me of this young indigenous woman coming back from school in the East, and now she's going to come, and she comes back to the reservation, etc. And I said, well, you got to beef up that part. That's not much. So they said, okay. But then I said, if I'm going to do it, then I want all of the indigenous parts to be played by indigenous people. We said Indian in those days. And they said, oh, no, we couldn't do that. You know, there are 36 extras or something in this movie. But don't worry about it. We've got Filipinos. We've got Koreans. We've got Armenians. We've got Jews. We've got Italians. Besides, our makeup people can turn a dog into a cat. And I said, oh, you're not getting it. You're not getting it. It's more important than just fooling white people. See? Can you imagine The Sopranos if there had been no Italians? Except for Tony Soprano? If everybody else had been Scotch and Irish and you know, English and et cetera, it wouldn't be the same. So it's a matter of experience. Our director is half indigenous. Eagle Vision is an indigenous company. So we have a lot of, we have indigenous people on this project, and it was real important to me. Not because I'm sticking up for my side, no, but because of the experience. The indigenous experience is a real thing. It's, and I want to share it with the world. It's so wonderful. But if you don't use any indigenous people, then all you're doing is, you know, fooling audiences.
I was saying before, I saw you at Imaginative at the Phoenix Theater, and I was blown away because you're different from a lot of musicians or performers. You're not like this puppet who's like on the stage and people watch. You have this interaction, like you read the crowd and you talk back and forth with them. So I wonder, where did you develop this? Like, was it just that one concert, or are you always like that?
I think I'm always like that. I think I'm always, I mean, for my kind of audience, I mean, they pay money to come and see me. So I figure that probably at least half the audience knows what I'm about. But it's funny, you know, some people come to see me. And I'm, my songs are so diverse. You know, I write bluegrass and jazz and pop and R&B and everything. I write everything. And I know that some people come and they want to hear, you know, Up Where We Belong and Until It's Time For You to Go, those love songs. But then I'm singing about indigenous issues and Universal Soldier, and other people are just the opposite. They want to come and hear those hard-hitting activist songs, and why has she got to sing that pop crap, you know? They don't realize that I wrote that, too. Right. So for me, it's all fun.
You're like Dolly Parton.
Yes, thank you very much. Oh, I just love her. And she's great, and she's great with an audience, and she really enjoys it. Yeah, I think we're mutual fans, Dolly Parton.
Finally, as a famous musician, you're able to use your platform to help different causes. So what thing that you've done are you most proud of?
Well, around the same time as I did the Virginian, this is the late 60s, maybe 67, 68, I started a scholarship foundation called the Nihiwan Foundation for American Indian Education. And Nihiwan, it means talk Cree, but what I really mean is be your culture. Be your culture. So I started a foundation, and I found out maybe 20 years ago that two of my earliest scholarship recipients had gone on to be the founders and presidents of tribal colleges in their communities.
That's great.
Dr. Lionel Bordeaux and Dr. Francis Bicente. They took that little gift that I gave them and they maximized it beyond my wildest dreams. So that's what I most, I don't know if I'll call it proud, but I'll say, oh, that's the moment in my life that I really, really celebrate.
What a little kid needs to push them in the right direction or open the door for them.
Yeah.
Amazing. Buffy St. Marie, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure, Daniel.
Buffy St. Marie, Carry It On, has its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Saturday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.